Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, Dan here. We don't have a new Can't Bowl, Can't Throw episode because Kat's sick and has lost her voice. So perhaps to tide you over, here's an episode of The Ridiculous Ashes, the first one of the 2013 Ridiculous Ashes for you to enjoy. This is the Ridiculous Ashes podcast. I'm Dan Libke. With me is Alex Bowden.
Hello.
We're covering historical Ashes series to find out which nation is more ridiculous at cricket. Is it England or is it Australia? And the new series we're about to cover is the 2013 Ashes.
Yes, it's a new series, so I'll try and do a proper, this is the way it works bit, because I sometimes skip over this a bit. But new series, potentially new listeners, this is what we do. Each episode, we look at one test match, and revolutionaries that we are, we do them in order, starting with the first one of the series, second, third, fourth, and fifth. The actual result of the match is not that important, not in itself. We instead pick out the most ridiculous moments delivered by each side, and at the end we pick out our top three, and we award 3, 2, and 1 points to these three moments. And whichever team scores most points wins that ridiculous Ashes test. And then next episode we do the next test, and at the end of the series we see who's won more tests and who's taken that ridiculous Ashes series.
Yes.
Ridiculousness comes in many forms, and a lot of this is about weighing that up and defining and redefining it. And I think our definition is quite malleable. I think we squidge it around quite a bit, but we like to think it makes sense within each episode, at least. I'm English, so I'll nominate England's ridiculous moments. Dan is Australian, so he will nominate Australia's, and then we shed our nationalities to decide on that top three at the end.
Yes.
Shall we, as it's the start of the series, should we set the scene for the series first?
Yeah, that's always a good idea before one of these series. So we'll do a bit of a preamble, let everybody know where the two sides were ridiculous cricket-wise heading into the series. So I'll start with the Australian perspective, because this was a side which is like in terrible cricket form, but just in absolutely outstanding ridiculous cricket form.
It often goes that way.
It does indeed, yes. Earlier in 2013, just before this Ashes tour, Australia had gone to India and they'd lost 4-0. I mean, there's no shame in that. But more hilariously, before the third test, four players, Shane Watson, James Pattinson, Mitchell Johnson and Usman Khawaja, were all suspended for not doing their homework, which is just a magnificent series. Watto immediately flew home for the birth of his first child for that third test that he was suspended for. And then he flew straight back for the fourth test, where an injury to Captain Michael Clarke meant he was now the captain. And I will, of course, be covering all of this in a future Ridiculous Border Gavaskar series podcast. But then a few months later, less than like 3 weeks before this Ashes series began, Australia sacked their coach, Mickey Arthur. They said, Darren Lehman, you're up for the job. And this was shortly after David Warner had been suspended for punching Joe Root in a pub, which in turn came shortly after Warner enthusiastically tweeted, "How good are turtles?" after seeing a documentary on the BBC. So Australia were just brimming with nonsense confidence at this point. It's a little bit difficult to see how England can match them, but what were England up to?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like form going into a series, that's like it's like a tsunami coming towards England at this point. I'm not sure it's rarely has a team been in finer form than that. England were, I don't know, really. They were post Andrew Strauss and just sort of hoping, like in terms of actual cricket, just sort of hoping they could carry on much the same under Alistair Cook. But obviously, Strauss's retirement meant they had a worse opener and a worse captain. And quite a few other players were tipping past their peaks. Yes. Probably a year or two past their best. But ridiculousness-wise, Kevin Peterson had fallen out with everyone big time in 2012 at the end of Strauss's time. And then they'd had the fairly laughable reintegration thing, which they'd made big play about.
So to refresh my memory on this, so Peterson basically was suspended or was given a rest, or what exactly happened there?
Yeah, he was just out. I think he was kicked out, unavailable for selection for a time. And then they decided to bring him back, and it was all really formal. The reintegration thing was really formalised. It was an absolute joke. And he was recently back in the side after having fallen out with basically everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that had overshadowed everyone else, really. So yeah, it was hard to say what kind of ridiculous form everyone else was in because it had all been about KP, really.
From a less ridiculous standpoint, just from a pure cricketing standpoint, this was actually the first time in almost a quarter of a century that Australia had come to England without the Ashes in their possession. So that was very, very strange. And frankly, they didn't have much hope of winning the back either, because I think the 2010-11 series had been very eye-opening for Australian fans. Because I think Australian fans had said, all right, 2005, that's fine because we whitewashed you in 2006-07. And then we looked at 2009 and said, oh, I don't really know what happened there, but that's probably just another weird fluke and, that'll be okay. But then being thrashed at home in 2010-11 had a lot of Australian fans going, oh, wait a second, are we a shit side now? and perhaps even worse than that realisation was, are England actually good? And so, yeah, I think 2013 was the first time in a very, very long time that Australian fans went into an Ashes series not expecting to win it.
Well, I think we were in a very unfamiliar position as well for kind of the reverse reasons. I think England fans were cautiously confident, but like you say, years of experience, like, it meant we had quite a troubled relationship with hope, let alone expectations.
Yes.
So it was very, very qualified optimism. Australia did seem pretty messy, and England were much the same side that won down under. So, I would say England fans were as confident as an England fan can be ahead of an Ashes series, really.
Yeah.
Not very.
All right. So that's kind of laid the platform of what we're about to deal with here. So I'll just run through a quick summary of what happened non-ridiculous cricket-wise in the first test.
Yeah, go ahead.
So we're at Trent Bridge for this first test, and England captain Alistair Cook, he won the toss and decided to have a bat. And the top six for England all reached double figures, but failed to reach 50 because Peter Siddall came from nowhere. He took 5 for 50 to knock England over for just 215, which didn't seem like enough at first, but then it seemed more than enough because Australia pretty much immediately collapsed from 108 for 4 to 117 for 9. But then there was this staggering counter-attacking 98 from the number 11, teenage debutant Ashton Agar, who was inexplicably selected ahead of Nathan Lyon, somehow teamed up with Philip Hughes to see Australia take a 65-run lead after they added 163 for the final wicket. England batted again, and despite a couple of early wickets, there were half centuries from Cook and Kevin Peterson, and then a 138-run seventh wicket partnership between centurion Ian Bell and Stuart Broad. That meant England finished on 375 all out, which meant Australia needed 311 for victory. And at 231 for 9, Australia were pretty much doomed. But then there was another bold last wicket partnership. This time it was between Brad Haddin and James Patterson, and they took Australia to within 15 runs of victory before James Anderson completed a 10-wicket haul for the match by having Haddin caught behind for 71.
Quite a match.
An absolute banger of a test match in my book, by which I mean literally in my book. I put it 14th in my rankings of the 50 greatest Australian cricket matches of the past 50 years, which is available in all good bookstores.
It's good in my book too, which is unpublished.
All right, so let's go through these nominations, shall we? Do you want to go first with this one?
Yeah, I'll go first. I'm kind of a bit uncomfortable covering this series and this match in particular because of how ridiculous it is, and people remember it as being ridiculous, and
yes,
loads of it is so familiar I almost feel a bit redundant, like what we're going to add. But my first nomination sidesteps that because I'm going to go with something a lot less obvious, which is Jonathan Trott's test match.
Mm-hmm.
This is a slightly greedy nomination because it actually comprises three moments.
always a good move, you know,
yeah,
slight nomination,
just lump them in together. But he had a quietly ludicrous match, and I think it's worth highlighting. So in the first innings, he inside edged the drive onto his stumps, and he was furious about this, at which point he did what all of us want to do when you're furious when you get out, which try and twat the stumps out of the ground with your bat. So he advanced on them, and he got his bat up, and he was about to swing, and I think he's in the sort of downswing when you can see him have a rethink. His conscious brain kicks in and says there's going to be a terrible consequence if you go ahead and do this. So he just kind of reins it in. And what I really love about this is that it's not really that bad a thing, is it? It's just
a bit
of wood.
Yeah, an umpire would have just come over and put them back in if he did it, but then there would have been an aftermath.
Yeah, there's no real world consequence to this, but as a cricketer on TV, people would be aghast if he'd have hammered the stumps with his bat. So he realises this, and what he does instead is he just kind of stares them out for a bit, like it's the stump's fault. Like,
yes.
So that's the first moment, and it's just very nice. It's always Jonathan Trott as well. I think there's a lot sort of going on in there.
There is indeed, yes.
The second thing is, as we were prepping for this episode, I do what I quite often do, is check my own website, see if I'd written anything about the match. And one of the posts titled, "We were at Trent Bridge today," which was news to me. I had totally forgotten I'd been at this match, but it did jog my memory. And one of the things which I remarked upon at the time, and I remember vividly, probably because I wrote about it, was that Jonathan Trott was fielding at fine leg. And who were the openers for Australia? Was it Watson and...
It was Watson and... wasn't Ed Cowan. It was Chris Rogers, I think.
Yeah, so right-hander, left-hander. So it might have been the start of the inning. Jonathan Trott was at fine leg, but he was at fine leg for both of them. So they were sort of taking singles, and he was going from fine leg to fine leg. And then at one point, this is the way I remember it. He went from fine leg for the right-hander to fine leg for the left-hander. Then it was the end of the over, and he went to the opposite fine leg, and then there was a single. So he was basically just doing complete laps of Trent Bridge, while everyone else was just kind of shuffling around in the middle. Jonathan Trott was just covering miles and miles and miles. That was just a very vivid memory for me, and something you don't really sort of see on TV. And the third thing was his golden duck in the second innings, which is a thing in itself. But he was given not out LB W and almost certainly hit it, but Australia reviewed it, and it was then given out by TV umpire Moraes Erasmus, which is quite the move. Sky Sports, who supplied the hotspot cameras, told Erasmus that the delivery to Trott was not recorded because the technology had been queued up to show the previous delivery, which was obviously a dismissal. It was Joe Root getting caught down the leg side. And I've got a quote from hotspot creator Warren Brennan, who said, "My operator did not trigger the system in order to cater for the Trott delivery. Instead, the operator sat on the Root delivery in order to offer a replay from the previous ball, and did not realise until it was too late that he should have triggered the system for the Trott delivery as the priority." But the silly thing is that Root didn't even review his cut behind. But if he had, there was nothing on hotspot.
that's just a wild couple of deliveries of events. So, I mean, its entire test is a masterclass on comedy reviewing and not reviewing, as we will see as we go along.
And obviously, while all that's going on and Trott's walking off, it's about to be a hat-trick ball as well. So
yes.
It's very hard to sort of hold all this in your head.
Yeah, I mean, he was, if there wasn't an inside edge there, then he was definitely out, because it was a classic stark, in-swinging, unplayable Yorker. But
yeah.
I think everybody, you know, was pretty convinced that he got a tiny feather on it on the inside edge. But that was very funny. Yeah. I mean, not so funny for poor old Jonathan Trott, who at least didn't think of hitting the stumps. He might have thought of, you know, hitting the third umpire on the way out, or
his own legs.
Yeah.
And maybe trying to hit his own bat with his bat. Maybe his bat was to blame. I don't know how you'd pull that off.
Yes.
You'd need to do a Mike Carberry style bat snap to achieve that.
All right. So that's a very fine nomination. My first nomination is the selection of Steve Smith, which we do have a regular segment on this podcast called Hindsight Corner, which is where things... don't seem ridiculous at the time, but are ridiculous in hindsight. This is pretty much the opposite of that, because selecting Steve Smith to play in a test match doesn't seem ridiculous at all now. But at the time, it was very, very strange, because he'd played 7 tests by this stage. He had more wickets than 50s. He had 4 wickets and 3 50s, which was probably not that surprising since he was supposed to be a leg spinner. But in this test, he was selected to bat at 5, which was a little peculiar. He had a batting average of 32.3, a higher score of 92, but he still didn't really seem like a number 5, particularly in comparison to, you know, predecessors such as Mike Hussey and Steve Waugh. He didn't really seem in that kind of league. It was all very laughable to select Steve Smith as a specialist batter.
Yeah, he came into the side for the series in India, I think.
Yes.
I think he only made it into the squad. He came back in largely because he bowled spin. You know that thing you always do if you go into Indy, you pick the bats yes. and you bowls a bit of spin. And then he got a game when Watson Khawaja was suspended.
Yes. Yeah, might as well chuck him in. He at least did his homework, presumably.
Yes. Key rewarded for that. Made 92 and just sort of hung around. He wasn't in the original Ashes party, but then he came in after the Warner thing.
Because Warner had been sent off to South Africa at this stage with Australia A because of the punching Joe Root in the head thing.
Yeah, go to South Africa.
Yes. I think the running gag at the time was that Steve Smith was being selected because he was, quote, great in the dressing room. He was a jokester and everyone liked having him around.
Yeah, that was his own fault because I don't know if it's his own fault, but he gave an interview where he'd said, it was a couple of years before, I think, where he said it's about having energy in the field and making sure I'm having fun and making sure everyone else is having fun, whether it be telling a joke or something like that. And I reckon if he hadn't said whether it be telling a joke or something, I reckon he'd have got away with that. If just, you know, being energetic and things. But as soon as he mentioned, like, telling a joke, everyone was like, oh, is that why you've been picked? Which seems really weird now because he seems like Steve Smith's personality now just seems the opposite.
Exactly.
Of that. It just seems like he's super focused, inward-looking, crazy person.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I can't imagine Steve Smith cracking a joke at all. Like, the funniest thing he's done in recent times is get trapped in an elevator and have Marnus come feed him M&Ms through the door.
You can't claim credit for that, can you? He's the straight man in that scenario.
Exactly. Back in those days, you can find these great photos of him, like, playing with lion cubs, all delighted, and he's dressed in zebra onesies, and he's lots of fun. He's lots of making sure everyone else around him is having fun as well.
Clearly, fun was his Achilles heel, and once he renounced fun, he became this incredible test batsman.
Yeah, maybe.
Make note, kids. No fun.
As kind of an example of the level of kind of disdain in which he was held, I found a tweet around this era by friend of the podcast, Peter Miller, at The Cricket Geek, and he pointed out in absolute amazement that Steve Smith had played more matches for Australia than Brad Hodge. # cricket believe it or not, which struck everybody as insane at the time. Damian Martin actually manually quote tweeted Peter with the one word response, joke. So, you know, he's amusing Damian Martin as well, I think. But yeah, I mean, despite all this scepticism, Smith made 53 and 17 in the test. Didn't bowl a single delivery, enough to get him a start in the second test. So there you go. That's my nomination. Steve Smith being selected.
Yeah, it's a quietly good nomination, that, actually. Yeah, I like that. My next nomination, similar to the previous one, so again, a bit greedy, but I reckon I can get away with it this time because I'm confident it won't get any points. And it's Stephen Finn's test match, but I've got to mention it because there's one element of it in particular that I absolutely love. This one's even bigger. Actually. There's 4 elements to this one.
Oh, wow.
So number one, Finn was caught behind for a golden duck in the first innings. Pretty silly in itself, but then he reviewed it and he'd hit it. So that's pretty good. Number two, he got as close to a hat-trick as you like to get in Australia's first innings with his delivery that I'm pretty sure went through Michael Clarke's off bail. It was so close.
Yeah, because he just dismissed Watto caught it slip, then Ed Cowan first ball caught it slip, and then Clarke came in and Clarke played a missed, yeah, as you say, one that, yeah, I don't know how it didn't either take the edge or bowl him or both.
Yeah, either or. Number three, late in Australia's second innings, he did a crab dance, and this is my favourite one. This is the one that I'm like, it's all hanging off the crab dance, really. It's probably my favourite moment of the entire match, which, given the match, is quite something. But so he was fielding out in the deep. Brad had in like was haddening it there. He was haddening it. Yeah, that was precisely what was happening. He haddened it out that in that general direction, and Finn just clearly didn't see it. And because he didn't see it, there was absolutely no reason for him to move, because what was he moving towards? He had no idea. He didn't know where to go. But he wanted to show willing, so he sort of skittered side to side, you know, like a real look, I'm trying thing. So he's left and right, and just looking like you're keen and you want to, I want to make the catch. The only issue is I have no idea where the ball is. And I like the mentality, and the showing willing is really key to that for me.
Yes,
and then not long after that, there was another moment, which not quite as good, but another sort of, I think it was probably, presumably Haddon again.
It was Haddon, yes.
Towards him. And he appeared to try and take a catch with his mouth, like a deep square, like basking shark. There's a slow-mo replay where you see Finn closing in on the ball, and his mouth is so wide open. I think he's sort of, I don't know if he's still thinking of like his crab dance effort earlier. He's thinking this is a chance to make amends. So he's very excited. And his mouth's open, he's gasping, and you can see he's excited. And as he gets closer, his mouth just seems to get more and more open until he's basically just like this giant mouth. And I don't think he takes it, but
no. It was a very tough chance. It was kind of the equivalent of that ridiculous catch that Glenn McGrath took that time in Adelaide, where like he had to run a long way and then dive full length, and he just
yeah.
Didn't quite
so
get
he
that.
Got a long sight of it, and because he's sort of running towards the camera, you see him along, sort of thinking about it. But it's one of those where you're not standing under it; you're actually running towards it. So it's a very active but prolonged thing. I can't really describe it, but it was great. Not as good as the crab dance, but great.
Yeah, the crab dance was spectacular. All right, here we go. Time to bring out the big
guns
here.
Are we into it now? We're into the thick.
Let's get serious about this test. Let's get serious about the ridiculousness of this test. Because my next nomination is Ashton Agar's 98.
Well, there's a right out of left field. I didn't expect that one.
Yeah. All right, strap in. All right, so just being selected in the side was complete nonsense. That was Darren Lehman basically was just no real reason to select Ashton Agar. It just felt more like a desire to make a statement as a new coach. I don't think he really believed that Agar was a better spinner than Nathan Lyon. pretty much nobody in Australia had ever heard of him. But Lehman said, nah, I'm the new coach. I'm going to do something, pull something out of my hat. And in his hat apparently was Ashton Agar. So poor old Nathan Lyon gave it a miss, which there was a theoretical problem with this as well, which a couple of people pointed out. Lyon was the keeper of the team song, so if Australia were to win the match, it was unclear who'd sing it. Presumably Ashton Agar has a beautiful singing voice as well, so...
Yeah. I mean, presumably Australia just weren't that confident. They didn't feel it's an issue to leave out the song keeper.
Yes. So anyway, Agar's in. Agar's batting at 11 because he's just this young kid. And, you know, Australia in their first innings collapsed 117 for 9, which felt very, very typical at the time. Australian fans, you know, they just toured India, so they were very resigned to this kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
And then Agar did this carefree counter-attack, which was, at the time, felt like the most thrilling thing you'd ever seen in your life. It was just absolutely crazy. I went to a wedding the next day, and everybody there was talking about the Agar innings, and I'm not talking about to me because they knew I was a cricket fan. The minister worked it into his pre-wedding material. he basically just ham-fisted, you know, an Ashton Agar reference into the surface as he was marrying these people. It was just absolute Agar mania for you know, at least a couple of days. So he became the first number 11 to score a 58 on debut. It was the highest 10th wicket partnership at the time. Highest score by number 11. And it was quite... it was one of the most ridiculous and most fun few hours I've ever had on social media. Pretty much everybody on Australian cricket Twitter could barely contain themselves. I was making jokes... and pretty much every joke I made quickly turned into actual things that happened. So I tweeted, no pressure, Agar, but we need a record 10th wicket partnership here. And he went and did it. Like, I did that as he came to the crease. It was absolutely bonkers. And at one point I coined the phrase Agar bomb to describe the sixes that Agar was hitting, which, among other things, got a reply from an excitable former Australian cricketer, one who'd played just a single test 18 months earlier before injuring himself. And this cricketer replied to me, he keeps smashing Agar bombs! ! That was a young Pat Cummins who was very excited about this. And of course, as we know, as brilliant as the innings was, as brilliant as the, you know, the response to it was on social media and everywhere else, he was caught by Swan off the bowling abroad for 98. And his reaction is just this extra layer of nonsense, which an adorable shrug of, oh, well, these things happen. Just one of the most bonker things I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think sometimes, particularly in the moment, you think, oh, no, he could have had 100, but with, well, is this hindsight corner? I'm not too sure. The benefit of hindsight.
Hindsight corner.
The being out for 98 and the reaction to it is more memorable than making 100, I would say.
Because
it's the contrast with everybody else as well, because there's visible dismay in the dressing room, like it cuts to the Australia dressing room, and everyone's just, you know, the head in hands or like, you know, on the railings and things. They just like absolutely gutted. Graham Swan's going off his nut. He's just like throwing the ball and screaming and going wild because he's caught Ashton Agar.
Well, why wouldn't he be? He's just caught out a batter who's averaging 98 in Test cricket. Of course he'd be going first.
That's true. But up until that morning, he'd probably never even heard of Ashton Agar. He's going absolutely wild. Whereas Agar's just kind of, he's coming to go. The commentary of the innings, if you watch the highlights, is basically just Jeff Boycott saying, shot, for every single boundary. That's basically just all it is. Except at one point where he likens Agar to Sobers, to Gary Sobers, which sounds like a big compliment, except I'd noticed that in England's innings, he'd liken Stuart Broad to Gary Sobers, which diminishes that a touch, I would say.
So Boycott didn't rate Sobers, is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, I guess so. But this, for England fans, this kind of felt like familiar territory because England had also conceded the highest score by a number 11 12 months earlier when Tino Best had made 95. So this was just an annual tradition. And then a year later, Jimmy Anderson would make 81 against India batting at number 11. It was just a thing that happened that just felt so, so familiar.
They're still the three highest number 11 scores. So it's just a wild trio of years for England cricket fans there.
Yeah. And there's a certain thing about last minute wicket partnerships as well, where, you know, they hit a few early on and everyone's kind of thinking, oh, this is, it'll be over in a minute. He's just going to miss one in a minute. There's a certain point, I think, usually, I reckon it's after the past 50, probably somewhere around 60, the fielding side suddenly realises we have got no control of this. This is completely out of our hands now. The gods have intervened, and this is just happening until something happens other than us that prevents this. And usually that's the player gets into the 90s and starts doing something slightly different. But from 60 to 90, I think you're just nailed on. You're just away. Unless there's like a match situation which makes it nervy before then.
Yes.
But if it's just a player slogging away, then till they get in the 90s, you just got to like suck it up and just...
The other great thing about this partnership was that, Philip Hughes at the other end, who was kind of renowned as a dasher himself, decided, I'm just going to just give a straight
second fiddle here with number 11. I mean, kudos to him for doing that, really, because it's, made the innings. Another great thing is that, so you were saying that no one really knew who he was. So between the first innings and the second innings, Agar batted at 11 in the first innings, and then he was promoted to number 8 for the second innings, which is mental. That's like, as a leap, that is crazy. How well do you know a player? How well do you really know them if you move them from number 11 to number 8 on the evidence of just one innings? I would say not very well.
Yeah.
And then when he came in, the crowd chanted, "Who are you? Who are you?"
as we mentioned earlier, Pattinson also took on the magic number 11 spot, and he was 25 not out, so he was unbeaten as well in the second innings.
Yeah, who knows what he could have gone on to. Mm. I remember joking that Australia batted all the way down to number 11. It's just that they didn't bat all the way up to number 1 was the problem.
Very good. So yeah, so Ashton Agar, that's my second nomination, and I dare you to match it.
Okay, I'll match it. Stuart Broad not walking. I think everyone knows this, but I'll briefly describe. Stuart Broad edged Agar behind. It came off Haddin's glove and went to Michael Clarke at slip. Mm-hmm. Broad stood still. Alan Dar didn't give him out. Australia didn't have any reviews left, and that was that. It was.
I mean, Australia barely even appealed for it at first. It was like, oh, good, Stuart Broad's out.
Yeah. There were two elements to the reaction. First of all, Australia didn't really react because it was so obviously out. And then once he'd been given not out and they'd realised that that was that, and they had no reviews. There was displeasure, but it wasn't like, looking back on it now, and the sort of reputation that it has, it didn't seem quite as jarring and as like, it wasn't, I don't know, they weren't up in the umpire's face like footballers or anything, were they?
Yeah, it wasn't Mike Gatting screaming at an umpire or anything. They were actually pretty... For all the criticism Australia players get sometimes, that there was just some mostly confused looks and a few muttered asides, yeah, and a slightly more dogmatic chewing of the gum from Clark, and that was pretty much it. Everyone, yeah, else in Australia lost their mind, but the players themselves...
That's it. I think it's the wider reception to it. So the public response and the media response to it was so enough. I mean, famously giving rise to Stuart Broad's treatment in the following Ashes series and walking in with the Courier Mail under his arm and all that, which we covered previously.
Yes, and to hear more about that, please see our earlier season covering the 2013-14 Ashes.
So, yeah, a lot of it is that. But the players themselves are a lot more level-headed. I mean, I'll come to that in a second. But the other thing I wanted to mention was that I'm sure I remember a period just before this, which I may have misremembered, where Alim Dar was right so reliably. He was correct so reliably that people were joking that you just shouldn't review his decisions because he had greater accuracy than Hawkeye. I'm sure that happened. But then, I don't know.
This test happened.
Yeah, I think maybe that's true. Maybe that's what happened. Although I remember Warren saying something about, Dar gets all the big decisions wrong. That's why he shouldn't be in these matches. So certainly in some people's eyes, he already had that reputation.
Yeah, although, you know, God bless Shane Warne, but he was not always accurate in some of his assessments on these things. He very much lived in the moment, did Shane?
That's true. So just to give a couple of the reaction. First of all, we'll give Stuart Broad's reaction, because this is, I would argue, the definitive Stuart Broad moment, because it's annoying, it's brassy, it's shameless, and he's almost proud of it afterwards. Stuart Broad said, "It wasn't as clear cut as everyone had thought, although I knew I'd hit it." Which is almost contradictory, but it's a pretty good assessment of the situation.
Yeah.
And then Peter Siddle was interviewed about it afterwards, because everyone, yeah, I think it's one of those where play goes on and maybe not much happens for a little bit, and it gets talked about more and more, and it builds, the moment builds more than maybe even the players realise. So Peter Siddle was asked about it afterwards, and he said, how many people have ever walked? Some. That's right, some. So Peter Siddle's on Stuart Broad's side. He's not exactly rattling his sabre, sort of enraged about it. He says, obviously people are going to be frustrated, but it's hard out there for players, for umpires. It's a long day. It's a tough day for people out there. Things are going to happen. We just have to deal with it. That's just a part of the game, and spectators have to understand that, that there are times when things like that happen. So Peter Siddle, incredibly phlegmatic about it.
He's far too measured and reasonable for an Ashes series. I'm not sure what he's doing out there.
No. He was very much the senior statesman by this point, wasn't he? Because all before the series, there'd been all the new young bowlers, Pattinson and Stark, had been talked up as being like the real game changers. And then day one, Peter Siddle had gone out and taken 5 wickets.
Yep. Yes. I particularly like that it was Agar who theoretically should have taken his wicket, because Broad was the one who got Agar. Agar should have had Broad. And I particularly like the lead up to the Broad non-wicket, because Agar's first wicket was caught at slip, his second wicket was caught by Haddon, and his third wicket should have been rebounded off Haddon and caught at slip. So yeah. Magnificent. And the fact that Australia had no reviews left, delicious.
Yeah, that was a key element.
Which brings me to my final nomination, which is burning reviews. Because despite Broad's not walking and Australia having no reviews to correct the situation, Australia went into their fourth innings run chase, no qualms about burning reviews. Watto, out LBW, of course, reviewed it. Umpire's call, and in those days, umpire's call wasn't enough to retain a review, so that review was gone with the opener.
I think you'd bank on that, I think, if you're Australia. I think we're sticking what it was opener. That's part of the cost of having him open the innings. We could bat him at 7, but now they allow an extra review for the batters, but no, we'll stick him up top.
Yes, but after Watto, Clark feathered one behind. He decided he'd burn a review in the hope that Hotspot didn't pick it up. Maybe he thought that it was still being checked or hadn't reset from the previous delivery. Anyway, Eva's hotspot did pick it up, so he wasted a review.
I think this was the era of Vaseline on outside edges, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. That was the other rumour as well.
So maybe he was testing that.
Yeah. I'm still not entirely sure how that worked, but it seemed to be... Yeah, as we saw it, it worked both ways, because sometimes you want an edge to show up on Hotspot, and sometimes
yeah, exactly. Well, that was it. I think it was like you Vaseline the outside edge of the back. So yeah. That's more likely to be caught, and you leave, you know, you sandpaper up the inside edge, make sure there's definitely
yeah. Well, that makes sense. I mean, you
put a few little hot marks and heat up a few points on the bat, just to, on the inside edge, to hope that gets picked up and saves you.
Yeah. Anyway, I think reviews renewed themselves after 80 overs in those days, but I still think, you know, they were burnt so badly by not having one for the broad catch. They might have been a little bit more careful about throwing them away on these marginal calls. But no, they were just chucking them away. And then kind of as the perfect climax, England won the test via a review they had up their sleeve when Haddon was given not out, caught behind.
Yeah, the other thing to note is that if Australia still had reviews when Broad had edged to slip by the keeper, would he have walked? Because I don't know if you'd factor that in, but he would be thinking like it's like Broad's pretty brassy, but if you're more confident that you're going to be given out,
yep.
You just kind of sidestep that by just walking off. I don't think he would have, to be honest, but you know, it raises that possibility.
He should have come out and said he would have, though.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. That would have. I'm surprised that he didn't. Maybe I just haven't seen it, but that would be the most Broad thing to do, wouldn't it? Just kind of rub it in.
A rare miss from the great man.
Yeah, to just sort of find salt and sprinkle it over those wounds, rub it in.
Yeah.
This was the era when everyone just routinely made reference to reviews being there for the howler.
Yes.
I think people still say howler, but not so much. I think because when the first few years of DRS, that was the people just said it so often, it seemed like it was this defined thing enshrined in the laws of the game. That, oh well, that's
yes.
not a howler. You should not be using a review for that. That is not in the spirit of cricket to be using a review for a non-howler. It's outrageous.
Yeah, there were no such thing as tactical reviews. That was just for these mythical howlers.
Yeah.
But before the series began, I published an Ashes scavenger hunt where you scored points for spotting certain events during the series. And one of them was commentators start droning on about howlers after DRS controversy, 5 points. So apparently this was very predictable.
Yeah.
You could also earn 80 points if you spotted commentators start droning on about howlers after Australia's middle order turn into werewolves. So that was worth 80 points.
Right. Have you anything else to add to that? Or should we move into our usual unnominated moments, having our cake
let's
and
do,
eat
let's
it?
Let's do some unnominated ones.
Those are our three nominations each, but we always like to like highlight a few of the things that we spotted that worth a mention, but aren't eligible for the podium. First thing of mine, I've historically liked to pick batting collapses, and England in their first innings went from 213 for 6, which is real, or they'll be aiming for 300 here, to 215 all out, so 4 wickets for 2 runs, which was,
yep.
I'd say, a touch disappointing.
Yes, that was a decent little mini collapse at the tail there. I've got a joint nomination here for both sides, because it was very noticeable that 3 times in 3 innings we had a bowler on a hat trick. So we had Stark in the first innings, Finn in the second, as we mentioned, Stark again in the second innings, and then I think you spotted that Clark and Smith were out of consecutive balls in the fourth innings.
Yes, Clark to Broad and Smith to Swan. So
yeah,
every innings had a potential 3 wickets in 3 balls scenario, but no wicket actually delivered on it.
Yes.
I think Finn was involved in Stark's hat-trick as well, possibly.
Sounds very plausible, yes.
So he was really getting in amongst it. Minor one, but Stuart Broad's 65 off 148 balls is still his second longest innings after the 100 against Pakistan.
Very
That's kind
impressive.
Of a neat stat one.
England won the opening test match of an Ashes series for the first time since 1997, and you can hear us talk about that on our very first season, which covered the 1997 ridiculous Ashes. So scroll back up in your list of episodes there.
We've done quite well. We've advertised 2 of our previous series
yep.
within one episode. But they're all good.
They are.
I should emphasise, even the ones we've not been promoting. I can't remember what one of them is.
I think the missing one's 2009. We haven't promoted that. So go listen to the 2009 Ridiculous Ashes.
Yeah, refresh your memory. I'll maybe go and do that as well. A sort of minor point, but we've been through all the things that happened in this match, all the ridiculous things that happened. And man of the match was Jimmy Anderson, who's barely
yes.
warranted a mention.
Yep.
10-wicket match, which has kind of been overshadowed by everything else. But he bowled 56 overs in this test, which is quite a lot. And then later the same week, had to go out and bowl again in the next test. I mean, quite a few of the bowlers have bowled a good number of overs, but it's just a measure of like how hard an Ashes series is. That's kind of what you have to line up and do.
Very early on, the commentators were saying, "Oh, this could be over in 2 days," as you know, wickets were tumbling everywhere. England collapsed, then Australia collapsed, and then they thought, "Oh, this is going to be a 2 or 3 day test," and then eventually stretched out. And I did particularly like on the final day, they delayed lunch because Australia were 9 wickets down, but then they didn't get out, so they had the extra half hour, and then they took 40 minutes off with the match in the delicate position of Australia needing 20 runs to win and England still 1 wicket. So that must have been a very nerve-wracking lunch, I think.
I like that, though. I like having time to chew things over and assess the situation, and everyone comes out and everyone's on it from ball one.
Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to mention, this is from my day at the match. This was the first time I'd heard Beer Snakes get their own song. You know, the Beer Snakes, when they stack up all the empty plastic cups and make them into a huge giant snake, and it drips beer over everyone, everyone gets leery, and then, you know, you just eventually want
someone gets kicked out eventually.
Yeah, someone gets kicked out, hopefully, because otherwise the whole stand becomes sort of like war zone, this lawless, like, frontier town. But, like, at first, they're quite good fun, and this was one of my more positive memories of Beer Snakes, because everyone was chanting "Feed the snake, feed the snake." I didn't know they had their own song, so that was like a nice surprise for me.
Fantastic. I've got one final unnominated moment here, and this is just kind of the official hashtags that both nations had for Twitter. We had "Return the Urn" for Australia, and England just had hashtag "Rise" in all caps. So
yeah,
not quite
I don't
sure.
know what that was. I remember even at the time being a bit sort of
I mean, Australia's rhymed at least.
Yeah, and you knew what it was about.
Yes.
I think this is just a fairly abstract concept.
Yes.
Should we get into the votes?
Yeah, this is a tricky one. This is very tricky, because I think in any other test we've ever covered, either Broad or Agar would be an effortless three-pointer, because they're both spectacularly ridiculous. I'm not sure it's fair to pit them against one another, but I'm going to make the case for Agar, because I still think it was just one of the craziest things I've ever seen in my life. Easily the most ridiculous.
Easily the most ridiculous. And we're talking about the Stuart Broad. I mean, it's it's the ramifications of the Broad thing, because in the moment, well, actually, in the moment, the commentators were like, "Oh, well, he's out," and then the sheer gall of the man to just stand firm, and then the fact that the sort of ripples of this moment cascade through history. Stuart Broad's whole reputation in Australia is built on this,
being a shit bloke because of this one moment.
Yes, and this is you know, not just any cricketer we're talking about. This is Stuart Broad we're talking about. The whole sort of personality hangs off this moment. How can that not be the winning moment? How can that not be our three-pointer?
But I think Agar is equally defined by the 98. And, you know, Agar is not the ridiculous great of Stuart Broad, of course. But I think that Stuart Broad stretches across a whole you know, lifetime of ridiculousness, whereas Agar is just condensed into this one outstanding moment of just sheer absurdity. It is still the highest innings by a number 11 ever. And he did it on debut as a teenager, seemingly fearlessly, when Australia were whatever they were, 117 for 9. It's just absolutely mental, and you know, as I said, it was easily the most fun I've ever had on social media. I think it was just a crazy period of play.
Yeah, I'm sure you had plenty of fun off the back of Stuart Broad being a shit bloke as well.
That is true.
Is he not the grander figure out of the two? Is there not more like weight and heft behind his case because of that?
I don't know. That Agar moment is anyway. I'm not sure we get. I think this is the first time we've ever been deadlocked with neither of us able to win the other over.
Well, how do we decide this? Do we can't do what you can't share the points. I'm not happy with that.
No, I don't think that's right.
Arbitration.
I mean, maybe I'm misremembering how ridiculously thrilling the Agar batting was. Why don't we pause the podcast and I'll go ask Pat Cummins how he remembers it.
Okay, deal.
Okay, we're back and I've got a voicemail.
Okay, let's have a listen.
G'day guys, Pat Cummins here. Alex, I'm pretty confident you're going to think that Stuart Broad not walking is the most ridiculous moment of this test, which is just so predictable, just so bloody predictable, and a little bit sad, to be honest. I think it's been done to death by now. I mean, what's the big deal? A batter given not out, even though he should be in a tight Ashes test. Australia doesn't have any reviews to send it upstairs. Like, that happens all the time. I don't know why you're going on and on about this one. But anyway, I think quite obviously the Jägermeister, Ashton Agar, smashing 98 on test debut, batting at 11, smashing Agar bombs all over the place. I'm pretty sure any cricketer would have to agree this is the most ridiculous and brilliant thing to happen in this test match.
There you go. I think that settles it, doesn't it?
I guess it does. I feel a bit like... I've never been sledged like that before by someone of his stature.
There you go. You've been sledged by the Australian captain. I think you should take great pride in that.
It softens the blow. I think I'm happy to accept that he has the casting vote here.
Yeah, so there we go. Agar 3, Broad 2. Who gets the 1 point?
Pat Cummins. Does Pat Cummins get a point for his intervention?
Is that the official tiebreaker policy now? Ties will be broken by the most recent Ashes winning captain at the time of recording.
The current Ashes winning captain. That's now official Ridiculous Ashes policy.
All right. Now, let's see if we can find a real number one here.
So we've got... Well, let's quickly run through then what we've got remaining. We've got Jonathan Trott's test,
mm-hmm.
trying to twat the stumps.
Steve Smith.
Steve Smith being picked.
Yep.
So the crab dancing, which I don't know really. And Australia's reviews, which...
Australia's reviews, yes.
Kind of like propping up Broad a little bit there.
I think I'm tempted to give it to the Trott, mostly because of the nonsense with the hotspot, where the hotspot wasn't available to save Trott because they hadn't set it up to save Root, where it would have saved Root because it didn't show. Entire convoluted thing seems to sum up the test rather nicely, I think.
Yeah, that golden duck does seem to sum things up quite well.
So let's give 1 point to Jonathan Trott's test, and particular that moment.
Yeah.
So okay. I think that levels it up at 3 for Australia and 3 for England, which means the first test is a draw.
Yeah, that feels a fair result, really, given the contributions of both sides.
It does indeed.
And that kind of softens the blow of the whole 3 points for Agar thing for me.
Yes, fair enough. I'll let you go away and recover from Pat Cummins' brutal sledging. So thank you for listening. Check out Alex's website. He's at kingcricket.co.uk. Mine is at leebcricket.com. Yeah, you can follow us on Twitter. We're at Ridiculous Ashes, or you can follow us separately at The King's Tweets or at Leeb Cricket. And if you enjoyed this episode and want to receive future episodes early, you could support either or both of us on Patreon. Alex is at patreon.com/kingcricket, and I'm at patreon.com/leebcricket. And we will be back in a week with our coverage of the second test of the 2013 Ridiculous Ashes.
Unless you get this early, in which case we might be more than a week.
We might be more than a week if you got this early, in which case treasure this one, go back.
That's your reward, a longer wait.
So if not, subscribe to the podcast and give us your honest 5-star ratings on the podcast store of your choice, and we will see you next time.
See you.
There you go. I hope you enjoyed that. If you didn't, sorry. But if you did, feel free to search for Ridiculous Ashes on the podcast provider of your choice and subscribe. There's plenty of episodes there for you to listen to. We'll see you when Kat has her voice back. Bye.